A little-known chapter in history, the Great Dying. If the Mayflower had arrived on the shores of what is now Massachusetts 4 years earlier, it would have found a very different place than it did. Instead of an empty landscape, the pilgrims would have encountered a thriving community of Wampanoag people. What happened? A new film tells the story of the Great Dying. How, in the years between 1616 and 1620, as many as 90% of the native peoples of New England were killed by plague. That film debuts tonight on public television stations in New England, including Maine Public Television. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with the producer of the film, as well as experts on Indigenous healthcare and history, about the lessons of the past and why they are still so relevant today. Maine Calling is just ahead. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. A new film examines a period of in what is now New England's history when disease overtook the indigenous population due to the arrival of European settlers. Today, we're going to learn more about that history and the repercussions of that period. Joining me, Lisa Sakabason, who is co-director of Wabanaki Public Health, and she's a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe. Jim Smith, who is a filmmaker, and his new documentary, Surviving New England's Great Dying, premieres tonight on New Hampshire Public Television and here on Maine Public Television as well. And Harold Prince is Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Kansas State University. Surviving New England's Great Dying airs tonight at 10 and then Saturday at 2 on Maine Public Television. We invite your questions and comments. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That is a different phone number than for the pledge drive. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Congratulations, Jim Smith. I had a chance to see the film yesterday. It is a beautiful film. So well done. And I just want to ask you so many questions, but what I learned from the film is that when the Mayflower arrived, something we all learned about as children in 1620, the Mayflower arrived and came to this land where there were very few people. But what I learned from your film is that if it had arrived just 4 years earlier, there would have been many people on the coast of New England, as many as 100,000 people. What happened? What do we know about what happened in the years leading up to that arrival?
Hi, Jen. Hope you're doing well, and thank you very much for having us on. It's hard, as far as a number goes, it is hard to get an exact number, but clearly the toll here was extensive throughout what came to be known as New England. And the best way we can put things together is 1615, maybe a little bit later, there was some sort of interaction between traders or fishermen. And at that point, a disease, ailment of some type was inadvertently, it does not seem to be an intentional act, but in the course of interactions between indigenous populations and these fishermen from Europe and traders, a malady was passed on. And that sickness, the Europeans had immunity built up. But of course, this was the first time that the indigenous people came upon it. So they fell victim to it, and it kind of took off and really spread.
Wow. And you're saying as many as 90% of the people who lived in what we now call New England were killed.
It depends on, of course, what village you're talking about. But we did hear in the course of talking to experts numbers as high as 90%. At one point, we heard 60%. But suffice to say, there was a toll as far as death. There was a toll as far as cultural loss and that sort of thing. So it was extensive. The encouraging news is that these populations managed to persevere and make it through ultimately.
And that's why your film is called Surviving. The first word in the title is surviving. Lisa Saka Basin, I did not learn about this as a child. As a Passamaquoddy child, did you learn about this period in history?
Hi, Jennifer. The period of history is one that I was familiar with, but like you, this was not something I learned in school. I am a Passamaquoddy citizen that went to the public school system here in Maine, and I remember that Indigenous section when we learned about our history, and this was not a part of that section.
Is it taught today?
Well, that's a very good question, and I hope we are seeing those changes. You know, one great thing is, you know, Maine did pass a law that required, well, pretty much 20 years ago, that required Indigenous, real Indigenous history to be taught in our school systems. And that has not been widely adopted. I know that the Portland school systems have been working really hard to incorporate that module and that important history into their educational curriculums. However, this has not been something that has been spread across the state, unfortunately.
Harold Prince, I want to bring you into this conversation. I'm thinking about Jim Talk. I'm still trying to get my head around what kind of trauma these communities experience losing so many people. And Jim used the word survival, of course, because there are so many tribal communities here 400 years later. They have survived, but I can't even imagine the trauma of those survivors. Can you put some perspective on the generational trauma of this time 400 years ago?
Yes, and that is by even amplifying what Jim was just saying, and that is that if you go to the contemporary records, and I have one here in front of me from the 1630s, and that is the following text, and that gives you a percentage not of 90% kill ratio, but of 97.5% kill ratio. The mortality rate in some areas minimally was much higher even than 90%, which is unimaginable really for anyone who is dealing today with the pandemic of COVID, where we talk about fractions and fractions of the kind of mortality that was experienced by the Wabanaki and other indigenous nations. But I give you here the quote, just to give you an idea. This is from 1630. The natives of the country are at this time very few in number, though heretofore populous, destroyed by a great and general plague, which happened about 17 years since, leaving not the 40th person living, since which time they have never increased. They live near and among the English, but are beneficial to them only in the trade of beaver, which they exchange for our commodities. Their want of people makes them not feared by us as not being able to do much mischief, resistance, which otherwise doubtless which would do, as was found lamentable experience last year. So here, this is the end of the quote. So here you see that awareness that may be lacking today about the foundation of what resulted in the proclamation of what became New England and later the United States, that the contemporary people at the time were keenly aware of the advantage that the massive pandemic created for the new settlers.
That's right. And Jim, you talk about that in the film, and you talk about that they were aware of that. And something that you touch on in the film is how John Winthrop, the famous Puritan minister, viewed the plague that struck the native people.
Yeah, there was some feeling among some that this was part of some grand plan, that this was a higher power at work, essentially clearing out the land for the settlers. But on the other hand, there are pilgrim writings where they describe it as a very sad spectacle to behold when they did land and saw the Patuxet, current-day Plymouth, Massachusetts, in such a state with villages abandoned. So there was some writings, as you referenced, by Winthrop, but there was also some genuine sympathy, I guess, also on the part of some of the new arrivals.
And Jim, you found writings where pilgrims talk about coming to villages and finding them abandoned.
Abandoned and evidence of, you know, that it was done in a hurry. And that was initially, of course, puzzling to them until they sort of put it together and apparently, in some cases, exposed skeletons and bones in some sections of Patuxent.
Do we know?
If I may jump in. If I may.
Yes, go ahead,
quickly,
Harold.
Yes, by all means.
There was, of course, death was ubiquitous. People forget today that Europe was not a paradise of health, that somehow it didn't inflict disease and death all the time in European communities. And so death was very common for every European who had matured to, let's say, the age of 20. They had experienced death in their families. Pandemics and epidemics were galore. And when they came, the pilgrims came to what's now called the Cape Cod area, southern Massachusetts, about half of them died that winter. William Bradford's own wife died pretty much very soon after she stepped ashore. So the sense of death hung around the pilgrims as well. And so when they were starving and having basically been duped by the enterprise that they had engaged to for the Mayflower to send them across the Atlantic, they dumped them at the wrong place at the wrong time, and they were completely not prepared for that. And that meant that in the spring, when they come upon these abandoned villages and see the burial mounds, some of them begin to see what's in there, and they find gifts among which was corn. And so the first ironic situation of survival includes the opening of the burial mounds where the gifts for the dead were buried by the few survivors that then fled these villages.
Yes, and it was, as you mentioned, death was ubiquitous, Harold. Basically half the Plymouth settlement wiped out during that first winter, including my ninth great-grandfather, William White. And he was lost, and leaving his wife, Susanna White, on her own to raise basically my ancestors. So what you had was a situation where both sides, if you will, needed each other. Of course, Patuxent was decimated, but also these European settlers were in a very precarious situation. Their numbers greatly reduced as well. So in that respect, it altered history.
Lisa Sockebase, and to your point, the history that we learn sounds nothing like the history that we're discussing today.
You bring up a good point. And I also want to say that this data and the story that's being shared today hurts my heart. That while it may be history for most listening, these are our people. And many of us are working so hard today to overcome that historical trauma that you mentioned, Jennifer, as well as the impacts of something so devastating, the loss of so many of your people. So the history needs to be shared. We need to start telling the truth. And we also need to start honoring our Indigenous people that are telling these stories. And right here in Maine, our Wabanaki authors, they are plentiful. Whether it's Sherry Mitchell of the Penobscot Nation or Chris Newell from Passamaquoddy, Donna Loring, Donald Soctoma, all of those individuals sharing the impacts through their writings today. And I definitely urge you to dive in and learn about the history that you do not know because the system hasn't allowed for it.
Lisa Sockebase, a very important part of this conversation is one we haven't even touched on yet, and that's what I want to touch on after the break, is the legacy. This is a story of plague, and of course we're having this conversation during a pandemic, and we're having this conversation during a time in which there's vaccine hesitancy, and the time in between has been a story of mistrust of government, and often for good reason. And I want to touch on that, but we do need to take a break first. We are talking about a film that is premiering tonight called Surviving the Great Dying. We are talking about history. We're learning about a chapter in history that many of us don't know about. It is a period called the Great Dying, when many, many, if not most, of the Native people who lived in what is now called New England were killed by plague. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, with careers in home energy efficiency renovation. Learn more at evergreenyourhome.com/careers. And by Camden National Bank, committed to providing personalized local service by people who live and work in your community. Learn more at camdennational.com.
And you are listening to Maine Public Radio. Welcome, folks. My name is Scott Marshall, and I'm here with Susan Tran. And very dense topic, Susan, at Maine Calling this today, but an incredibly important topic, as was a quote, history needs to be shared. And you know, without Maine Public and the guests that we have on Maine Public today and our producers and folks behind the scenes putting this show together, it would be desperate that this story not be told and shared. And although it's a tough day to have our 60th anniversary fundraising drive, we're certainly pleased to ask for support to continue to be able to produce shows exactly like this, because this is the dialogue public broadcasting is able to create with our listeners and with our guests. So support, your support today would go to help us continue to put on shows like this at 1-800-866-1475 or online at mainepublic.org.
That's right, Scott. It's really public broadcasting at its best and what it is sort of intended to do. You know, surviving New England's Great Dying, this film, you know, we're talking about it today on Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio. It will air tonight on Maine Public's community film series at 10 o'clock on Maine Public Television. And it was produced by our neighbors at New Hampshire Public Television. You know, the ability to tell this kind of important, in-depth story is really, it's something that it is so unique to public broadcasting. And that is the type of work that your call of support will go to fund. You know, you are investing in this level of storytelling for Maine and New England when you call 800-866-1475 with your financial support.
Once again, that's 1-800-866-1475 or going online at mainepublic.org. Maine Public has been here in Maine for 60 years. We're celebrating our 60th year of bringing you stories in Maine. It's your support, our listener support, that allow these stories to be told. And it's your support today that will help us continue to produce award-winning programming like we're hearing on Maine Calling. So give us a call again, 1-800-866-1475. Just a minute left before we go back into Maine Calling. So call now while there's still time, and thanks.
Yes, call with your support of this legacy of educating, inspiring, sharing the stories of Maine. That is what Maine Public has been bringing to you for 60 years. Your investment today will help fund the next 60 years and beyond of this important work. 1-800-866-1475 is the number to call, or you can go online to mainepublic.org. Thank you.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are learning about an important chapter in the history of our region, the Great Dying. My guests are Jim Smith. He helped make the new documentary, Surviving New England's Great Dying. He's the producer of it. Harold Prince is a professor of anthropology at Kansas State University. And Lisa Sakabason is a Passamaquoddy tribal member and co-director of Wabanaki Public Health. You can share any comments or questions you have at email talk@mainpublic.org. You can comment on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or give us a call. This is a different number, 1-800-399-3566. Lisa Sakabason, I want to return to you. And we are talking again about the fact that we are having this conversation, of course, in the midst of another historic period. We're in the face of a global pandemic when public health officials such as yourself are trying so hard to make sure that people are vaccinated and protected against COVID-19. Talk to me about your role as a leader in your community, but also the legacy of mistrust of government in your community, and how all of this ties together in the work that you do.
Absolutely. Let me start with the mistrust. And what I would like to say there is that the mistrust that should be pervasive in this country is based on the stories of American Indians and people of color. There are many reasons why we may be distrustful of a variety of systems. First, they were not built for us. Actually, the contrary, they were built to target us. And so the mistrust is pervasive, and it should be pervasive for all of us, because of a system can have a history that targets a whole demographic of people the way it did. It can do that again, and it can do that to the community that you're a part of. And so that mistrust is something that we have to contend with today. We were absolute products and survivors of medical experimentation, forced sterilization of our Indigenous women. So when there were so many systems that supported the carrying out of the genocide of our people, we will have mistrust, and that mistrust is healthy. And that is something that we are working with today. While the majority of our community, our Wabanaki people, are vaccinated against COVID-19, our history that we've been talking about is one that is very familiar to us, and it's scary. It's scary to lose that many people. And then we have to also contend with that history where the system was set out to destroy. So we have to understand. We have to understand when people are fearful. And that is something that we try and do at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness. And I encourage other people to also understand where that hesitation and mistrust lies. Try to withhold judgment and hold more love. And that's what we're doing here every day. We're working with tribal leaders every day to ensure that we address the vaccine misinformation, as well as the accessibility of vaccine. And when people are sick and are in need of services, making sure that we show up each and every time. So that's what we're focused on here. But that mistrust should be well understood for all of us. And just having some understanding of that history, I think, allows us to understand at a greater level of where the struggles may be today.
And Jim, this is a big part of your film. You are not just doing a film about what happened 400 years ago. You're talking to tribal leaders in Vermont and Massachusetts about how they are approaching the pandemic today.
Yes, well, that, of course, you know, that's what made this project unique. We talk about an event 400 years ago, but we're also very much talking about current day situation, two touchstones of history, four centuries apart. So that definitely made it relevant, and we were able to explore current tribal efforts to combat COVID. So that gave it a foot in the 21st century.
And have you found that? And you found that the tribal leaders you talked to were among the first to get the vaccine, to set an example.
Yes, in a couple of different instances, they uh, they definitely were among the early recipients, and one can assume that that sort of carried through their populations.
Harold, is there anything you want to add to the looking at the pandemic today and tying it to the plague of 400 years ago?
Yes, very much. And that is to drive home the point what these numbers mean, because as Lisa earlier said, that it hurts her when she thinks about the fact that behind all these numbers are human beings who are suffering terrible deaths, and without all kind of equipment that may alleviate the suffering while they are dying, that we now see in internal care units. These people died of the plague, but also of smallpox later, wave upon wave of cholera, you name it. It's an incredible series. It's not just 400 years ago. These waves of epidemics striking Indian country have been horrific. If you think about the Mandan, when they are in the struck by a smallpox epidemic, the survivors found it so horrific to survive in that that landscape of death all around them that they committed suicide. A number of them just smashed their heads against rocks because they could not survive and see the incredible suffering. They rather died than survive in the midst of the was almost equivalent of a nuclear bomb that went off. If you just think about these numbers, I was looking at the numbers today. Just take Maine, for example, population of 1,345,000. The cases in Maine, if I'm not mistaken, are 112,000. The deaths in Maine are 1,250. But if you take the percentage of that, that's less than one promille. So if it had been 2%, which is extremely small compared to the numbers that we're now talking about with respect to Indian country, there would have been 26,900 dead. If 10% of the Maine population had died, we would have had 134,500 dead in Maine. If 90%, that was the number we used earlier with respect to the Great Dying 400 years ago, but if 90% of today's population in Maine had died, or would die, we would have had 1,210,500 dead and only 134,500 survivors. And that is less than half of the population of Cumberland County. So try to imagine, that's the real thing that I am concerned about, that we simply cannot comprehend the reality behind these numbers unless we begin to translate them in those horrific numbers, begin to translate them to what would happen to the state of Maine with a 90% population reduction due to disease, when only 10% can carry on the society as we know it. That's completely destroyed. And if you want to look at the long-term suffering that Lisa was referring to earlier in terms of the mistrust that comes from a system that brings death and disease. And it's more than death and disease, it's also a collapses of entire social systems, economic systems, and cultural belief systems. Because what do you do with that kind of death when your traditional healing methods are unable to rescue those of whom you love from their from the portal of death? So the interrelatedness of just, if you look at, yes, what precisely was that plague? Was that a bubonic plague? What was it? Which variety was it? Today we have, with all these varieties of COVID, we may think we have immunity, but there's another variety, a mutation, and suddenly you don't have that immunity. So it's not that that Great Dying suddenly stopped in 1619. The Great Dying was ongoing, and it's wave upon wave of mortality. And that reverberates to today and throughout Indian country. If you now look at the Amazon, there are still people who are not yet contacted. First contact with gold miners or loggers or missionaries or whatever you may have, you have a striking wave of epidemic that suddenly knocks out 50% to 60% of these communities, and sometimes even more.
Mm. We're joined now by Paula Peters. Paula Peters is calling from Massachusetts. She's Wampanoag, a journalist and an activist, and is featured in the film. Paula, thank you for making some time for us today. And so much I want to ask you, but I know you just have a little bit of time. But one of the things we were just talking about, people getting the vaccination, you receive the vaccination during the film for COVID-19. Why did you choose to do that, be vaccinated on as part of the film that Jim and Phil were making?
You know, I thank you. Thank you for having me. And I want to shout out a great thank you to Jim and Phil, because they did such a great job in bringing the story out. But, one of the reasons why I felt like it was important to show, to show where we were 400 years later, and that was important context, I thought. It was my personal decision to have a vaccine. It was being also provided to me through our Indian Health Services that our tribe provides to us. And, I felt like it was almost a responsibility for me to survive. I mean, if my ancestors had had any kind of a treatment or cure or vaccine, I mean, just think about how different our lives would be today, and how different our tribal lives would have been. So I felt like it was my responsibility to next generations to get the vaccine.
That's interesting that you said if that had been available, because another big question that's posed by the film, and a question that I know that you have thought a lot about, is if there had not been this plague, if there had not been the Great Dying, all of American history may have been different. Because if the Mayflower had arrived to this place, and instead of finding no people, had arrived and seen a village of 2,000 people that had been there 4 years earlier, the Mayflower may not have landed there.
Oh, it absolutely should. I feel like it would have been an incredibly different Patuxent, as we know from this film, was, it was a really vital village. And, had those people all still been living there, there's no way that the Plymouth colony would have settled there. Had there not been a consideration to seek out these folks as allies, maybe they would have been turned away. It's possible they would have told the ship to pack up and leave. So there are many different outcomes that I think would have happened.
Well, Paula, thank you so much for calling in and being part of our program today, and thank you for calling in today and being in the film Surviving New England's Great Dying. Jim, have you spent a lot of time thinking about what if this had not happened, and what if this had not happened in the time that it happened, right before the arrival of the Mayflower?
Yeah, as I said, the timing was very interesting, to say the least, coming right before the Mayflower's arrival. And that was a factor in both sides seeking accommodation with each other. And that's how plagues and various sicknesses affect history. They've affected history, as Harold probably can tell us more properly. But these sicknesses and plagues have impacted history throughout millennia.
Go ahead, Harold.
Oh yeah, yes. Well, that's absolutely true. But not only that, there's also a danger in American history, which makes it, and particularly in the Northeast, that makes it Plymouth-centered, Pilgrim-centered. That's not surprising, given the location of Harvard University in Boston, where the Massachusetts historians, and also therefore impacting Maine history, is forgetting a whole different narrative that is associated with Spaniards, of course, in Florida and in the Gulf of Mexico. What has happened there are waves of epidemics that came through the Spaniards, sailing up the Mississippi River, for example, by way of the area of New Orleans, but also in the point of Florida, where you had massive epidemics very early on, before the Mayflower landed. And since we're talking here about Wabanaki, the waves of epidemics for the eastern Wabanaki, the Mi'kmaq in particular, but also the Maliseet and the Passamaquoddy, preceded the arrival of the pilgrims in 1620. If you look in the Bay of Fundy, for example, and on the coast of Nova Scotia, but also in particular in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, where many Wabanaki lived, there was a massive depopulation starting in the 1540s, 1550s. So we're talking about 80 years earlier. So that whole area of where now is Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, and the north shore of New Brunswick, much of that area was depopulated, as was the entire mouth of the St. Lawrence River, all the way up to close to Montreal. It was the people who knew what that area looked like in the 1540s, 1550s, 1560s, describe it as completely devastated of population. There's nobody living there anymore. That later changed. But that allowed, for example, the French Canadians to move into what is now Canada, and with that kind of history. So we have a danger that we focus too much on the so-called Great Dying of 1616, 1619, because there's Great Dying going on all over Mexico, on the coast of Brazil, all of the coast of the Guianas, the Caribbean, massive death, and that all the way spread to the coast of Labrador.
Mm. Jim, it sounds like you've got some more films in your future. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Foley in Portland's Old Port, where you'll find jewelry by Maine designers as well as custom design and repair services. FoleyJewelry.com and by Sweetgrass Farm Winery and Distillery. Fine wines and spirits for your holiday table in Union and Portland's Old Port, sweetgrasswinery.com.
And you're listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Maine Calling, sharing and amplifying important stories like the one we're hearing today. You know, 60 years ago, Maine Public began a legacy of educating, inspiring, and sharing the stories of Maine and our region. That legacy continues today with programs like these. Now we look ahead to the next 60 years with renewed commitment to share all of Maine's stories, to bridge the gaps in access to education and information, and lead Maine into the next chapter. And you are our partner in this. Please celebrate 60 years of Maine Public now by investing in the next 60 years and beyond of this kind of important storytelling. 1-800-866-1475 is the number to call to pledge your support to make your investment in this work today. 1-800-866-1475.
Thanks, Susan. Or you can go online at mainepublic.org where your support will support shows like we have today here on Maine Calling. Something Maine Public also does is partners with a lot of nonprofits, other nonprofits that are out there and doing good work in Maine. The Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, MOFGA, as we know them, has opened a storefront because of COVID and the lack of ability to sell their wares at Common Ground Fair. Where Maine Public's also been an attendee for many, many years before COVID, prior to COVID. So they've opened a store in Freeport, Maine, and have offered us 10 $50 gift certificates. So anyone calling today at this time right now will be entered in. You don't have to do anything. Just call with your support at 1-800-866-1475, or as I said before, going online at mainepublic.org, and you will be entered automatically to perhaps receive one of these gift certificates. So just a small way of partnering with another wonderful nonprofit as a way of saying thank you for your support and the value of Maine Public beyond telling some of these stories that we're telling today.
And when you do call, consider becoming an Evergreen Friend. Our Evergreen Friends program is a sustaining membership. We like to think of it as intentional monthly giving. days of yore, we used to call it set it and forget it. But the truth is you don't forget it. You remember every single time you turn on the radio that you are investing, and you can choose the amount of your monthly membership. It can be, you know, $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever suits your budget and your needs. 1-800-866-1475 is the number to call to get your Evergreen Friend sustaining membership started. You could also do it online at mainpublic.org.
Once again, that's 1-800-866-1475. Call now. We'll get you shortly going back to our main calling, but you still have some time to call, share your support, be entered to win one of those $50 gift certificates from Mofka's storefront in Freeport. So again, go online at mainpublic.org, share your support. This is our 60th anniversary membership drive, 1-800-866-1475. And be as generous as you can be. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the lasting impact of what is known as the Great Dying 400 years ago and what we can learn from it. Joining us, anthropology professor Harold Prince with Kansas State University, Lisa Sakabason with Wabanaki Public Health, and Jim Smith, documentary filmmaker. And his film, Surviving New England's Great Dying, premieres tonight on Maine Public Television at 10 o'clock. Join our conversation. You can call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email if you're quick to talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or again, if you're quick, find us on Facebook or Instagram. Jim, do we know what this plague was? We know it wasn't smallpox, right?
Well, you know, the really honest answer to that question is, when it's so long ago, it's very difficult to ascertain exactly what it is. But from various scholarly writings, again, Harold probably has seen them, and from talking to the two professors that were involved in our documentary, the best guess at this point is something called leptospirosis, which has been known to spread from on ships, from rodents, that sort of thing, you know, inevitable, especially so long ago, that there would be some rodents on these ships. And as we understand it, you know, that is spread from animal to human, and that may have been the ailment. But let's be honest here. We can't say exactly for sure. It could have been one ailment. It could have been, I guess, for lack of a better word, a menagerie of different ailments. I defer to Harold on that. If he is, Harold, have you heard exactly what it might have been?
Well, the catchword is the exactly, because just like today we have with illnesses like Alzheimer's, right? And we now realize there's a complexity behind that name. And so we have these names that hide complexities that were not known at the time. The language that is used is almost invariably at the time the plague, and they make a clear distinction between the smallpox. So it was not smallpox, because the Europeans were very familiar with smallpox, and they name it specifically in the smallpox epidemic that strikes Massachusetts in the early 1630s. So that's right when the Puritans have settled in Massachusetts Bay. So there's that awareness that smallpox is a term that they use in contradistinction to the word plague. I think that there's a complexity of illnesses, some of which are derivatives of the major ones, which I have always thought was the bubonic plague. That was also the one that was spread by animals, ship rats and ship mice, but in particular ship rats with fleas, and these fleas that then come with the ships that have been, let's say, 6 weeks at sea, sailing from, let's say, Malaga, where they have just dumped fish. And then come back to the coast for fishing, and then do fur trading on the side. And then these fleas jump from the cargo to the humans, and the humans are in interaction with each other. It's striking that whether it's bubonic plague or some other plague-like phenomena that we don't really know and may never know unless we have perhaps in the future genetic data, paleogenetic data or genetic data that may shed light on what that person who might have died of that disease if proper permissions would be given to research these bones, that you might find an answer more precise than the ones that we are trying to derive from the historical records.
Yeah, and Lisa, it's one thing to think about this. You know, in terms of looking at historical records and thinking about it and learning on one level facts, but as human beings, especially human beings right now living through our own pandemic and feeling such loss, trying to imagine just what it would have been like to be living through that.
Thank you, Jennifer. You know, Harold mentioned earlier many, many startling statistics, and also mentioned it's really difficult to comprehend the loss. And what I would like to say is for those of you that it's difficult to comprehend such profound loss, that is an example of your privilege, and I'm envious. And privilege is protective. It's not hard for me and many other Indigenous people to comprehend the loss, because we live with it today. It's not separate from us. When you live 20 years less than the average Mainer, or you are burying far too many young people, or you still have the effects of the historical trauma that results in substance use disorders, that loss is very near. So that loss is with us even as we go through this pandemic. But as I talk about trauma, I also want to mention generational strength. And that is what we get from our ancestors. And that is how we get through the comprehension of all the loss that we're talking about today.
Jim, your film ends by talking about a new tribute, a new structure. Is it a structure or a park that's going to be built?
Yes, and this is noteworthy because the park, I think it's called Remembrance Park, and it will be on Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Now, in many ways, Coles Hill is already a sacred site. There's a sarcophagus there that contains the remains of the pilgrims who died during that first horrible winter, including some of my ancestors. So it's already a sacred site, as I said, but now it is being broadened. There's already a statue of the Massasoit Osamequin adjacent to the sarcophagus, but now there will be Remembrance Park, which will pay homage to a number of different dates having to do with the Mayflower, but also much more important or just as important, it will also pointedly remember the victims of the Great Dying as well. And what's noteworthy is that this is being done under the auspices of Pilgrim Hall Museum in Plymouth, which, you know, one might hear that title and think that it's only one-dimensional in that regard. But they are working on always being dynamic and changeable with the times. They have exhibits on the Great Dying, including some new tapestries which explore various dates in history as well. So it is ongoing, and it's very interesting that these sort of areas are being now part of Plymouth, Massachusetts, and again, under the auspices of Pilgrim Hall Museum.
I'm going to try to squeeze in one call. Peter and Camden, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. The little tidbit I want to share is the complexity of the relationship between Massasoit, Samoset, and Tisquantum. We refer to them as Squanto. All three survived the plague, and Tisquantum, was not, you know, present. He had been kidnapped and taken to Europe, England, had made maybe one, possibly two trips back. But amazingly, you know, history propels him into the void between the pilgrims who had no language skills whatsoever and the Wampanoag and Massasoit and the diminished ranks of warriors. And it put you know, tremendous strain, I would think, on Ascarmo, because why? He knew what was there before, and he knew how to talk about it. What did he tell them? You know, there were deep suspicions amongst many of the Native Americans about his role, and was he going to further, you know, the Pilgrims' agenda, or was he going to be a player for Massasoit to kind of fend them off?
Yeah,
or
so much more.
Them in?
So much you more. Know, history to explore, Peter. I appreciate you bringing up that element of it, and we are out of time.
Thank you, Peter.
Really important conversations to be had. I thank you, Jim, for making this film. I thank you, Lisa and Harold, for joining us today, for starting conversations that need to continue. Lisa Sakabason is co-director of Wabanaki Public Health. Jim Smith is a filmmaker, and his documentary Surviving New England's Great Dying is on the air tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television. And Harold Prince, Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at Kansas State University. Today's sound engineer, KG Akeem Oladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from CEI Maine. From heritage industries to the next big idea, providing advice and capital to help businesses grow. Learn more at ceimaine.org. And by Center Street Arts Gallery in downtown Bath, open Wednesday through Monday, 10:30 to 4, and Sunday noon to 4. Center Street Arts Gallery, LLC.
And this is Maine Public Radio. I'm Scott Marshallton here with Susan Tran, and we are celebrating our 60th anniversary membership drive with shows like the one you just heard on Maine Calling. Susan, I think that that is just part one, perhaps,
yes,
of that conversation. And that's the talent and skills of our Maine Calling team, is to have a show that I just wanted it to continue, frankly. I wanted to continue to talk about, to be a part of that conversation, and for Maine to have access to that conversation is so very critical. And it's donor support that allows these conversations to happen. So call now, 1-800-866-1475, or go online at mainepublic.org, where your support is put into programming here at Maine Public and on Maine Calling.
That's right. This really represents, you know, the best of public broadcasting and what the impact that it can have on our region. You know, this film that we've been talking about today, you know, it's such an important topic. The film itself will air this evening at 10 o'clock on the Maine Public Community Film Series, which can be seen on Maine Public Television. And the film was made by our neighbors to the west at or southwest, New Hampshire Public Television. You know, it's really, public broadcasting is in a unique position to tell these stories and to take the time to tell them carefully and in depth. That is what you are supporting when you call with your investment in Maine Public, 1-800-866-1475. That is the number to call with your support for this type of important programming. You can also go online to mainepublic.org and pledge your support now.
Educational, thoughtful dialogue, conversation. That's what Maine Calling brings us each and every day. And that's what public broadcasting is able to bring each and every day, Susan, to your point. And it's donor support. It's a partnership between our listeners, you, our listeners, and all of the entire folks that work here at Maine Public, be a partnership that allows us to continue to do the necessary programming, the important programming that you're listening to. And it's opportunity to make that gift right now at 1-800-866-1475. There's so many reasons why you should take the time to make that call. But today is a special opportunity because we are celebrating 60 years of existence here at Maine Public. November 13th, I believe, was the day, 1961.
That's right.
When WCBB went on the air for the first time, public television, and began a incredible tradition. I wouldn't know, frankly, what to do without public broadcasting in my life, from starting Channel 10, where I grew up in Hanover, Maine, to where we are today. the many stations, the many signals, the many journalists that we have on staff bringing us news of the day. You are listening to listener-supported Maine Public Radio at WMEW Waterville 91.3, WMED Callis 89.7, WMEF Fort Kent 106.5, WMEH Bangor 90.1, WMEM Presque Isle 106.1, WMEA Portland 90.1, and on the web at mainepublic.org.